Welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. This week, we'll be exploring the case of the Kansas City butcher, Robert Berdella Jr. Berdella was deeply influenced by the 1965 horror classic, The Collector. Berdella was an American serial killer who murdered at least six men between 1984 and 1987 in Kansas City, Missouri, after a period of torturing that lasted up to 6 weeks. We hope you enjoy.
Everybody, and welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. My name is McKenna, and this is DB. And today we're going to jump right into it because I feel like this is going to be kind of a long episode with just the amount of information that we've accrued.
Yes.
Today we're covering Robert Berdella, also known as the Kansas City Butcher or the Butcher of Kansas City. This guy's a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, for what, from 65 to what was he arrested in?
Hold on, I have to flip through my 10,000 pages of notes.
Yeah.
In 88, he was formally indicted by the grand jury.
So he was active for 20 plus years, which is...
Well, not really.
Well,
he killed his first one in 84. So it really was only 4 years of terror.
Oh, sorry. I was looking at the
say his birthday.
Wrong one here. Yep. Don't mind me.
So, for a year reign of terror, predominantly preying on male sex workers. Let's just start at the beginning, I guess.
Yeah. So, Robert Berdella, a little bit of background on him. Born January 31st, 1949, in a town in Ohio, which I cannot pronounce.
Cuyahoga Falls.
That.
Which is just south of Cleveland.
All right. And died October 8th, 1992. He was only 43, and he died in prison from a heart attack.
More about that later.
Yeah, but we'll get into that. convictions. He had 2 counts of first-degree murder, 4 counts of second-degree murder, selling amphetamine, sodomy, assault, sexual assault, and he was given life imprisonment without parole. I can't remember how many life sentences they gave him, but it was enough to... Six. Yeah, it was enough to make sure that he was never going to get out.
What's phenomenal is he had all those convictions, but, like, there's so many more because he took some hella good plea deals.
Yes. Technically he only had 6 victims, but it's approximated that he actually had between 19 and 25.
Yep.
Oh, hey, what do you know? My next thing, span of crimes.
Oh, there it is.
July 6th of 1984 to April 2nd of 1988. And everything actually happened in Missouri. And then he was caught on April 2nd, 1988. So, as McKenna said, 4 years of terror, not eight. I just can't do math. quick quote before we go into it. When he was asked about some of his murders, he described as some of the darkest fantasies becoming his reality, which meant he wanted to do these for a long time, and he finally did. And this all, he claims it was all based off of the movie The Collector, which was about a man who kidnapped a woman and kept her captive for, I can't remember how many years it was in the movie, but it's an older movie, like
1966 was when he saw it. So that's when it came out in theaters.
Fantastic movie. I mean, it's a classic horror movie. So if you haven't seen it, go check it out.
I also just love how in the movie it's unsuccessful, but he was like, oh, you know what? I'm going to do it. No, you're not.
Yeah, you know, all these killers keep doing that, thinking they're getting away with it.
Right. Like, oh, I'm going to do it right. No. So like we said, born in Cuyahoga Falls, Ohio in 1949 into a like deeply religious Italian Catholic household. His father, Robert Berdella Sr., was a die setter at Ford. And then his mom, Mary Berdella, was just a homemaker. They never missed a mass on Sunday. Berdella was a super loner. He had a speech impediment. He wore Coke bottle thick glasses because he was super nearsighted. He was also hypertensive from a young age. So he had high blood pressure. So he was on a slew of medications. So like this poor kid just didn't start out well. And then in 56, his brother Daniel is born, and Daniel's like athletic and like has a great aptitude for sports. And he quickly becomes his dad's favorite. And Robert Berdella Sr. already had an aptitude for abuse. He was known to beat Berdella is the one we're talking about, the junior, known to beat his son Robert with a belt. And he beat both boys with his belt, but as Daniel became the favorite, the amount of abuse that Robert Jr. underwent really increased, which obviously didn't help anything.
No, definitely not. According to his teachers, he performed very well academically, but yet they found him difficult to teach, both because he was just kind of that weird kid and he was a recipient of bullying by all the other students. So because of this, he seldom socialized. He never went out. He never really had any friends, kind of stuck to his home. And obviously, we just said how his home life was. He was emotionally and physically abused by his father. He was always kind of looked down upon because his younger brother was the star athlete, everyone they wanted. So when Berdella reached puberty, he discovered that he was homosexual. Obviously, in a deeply Catholic family, this is something he kept hidden for numerous years and didn't become open with it until, like I said, numerous years later. Nonetheless, he did have a girlfriend briefly in his early teens, but that didn't last very long.
Right. And so in December of 1965, his father dies of a heart attack while the family is visiting relatives in Canton. His father was 39 when he died. Robert Berdella Jr. learns about it 2 years later when he, or not 2 years, I'm so sorry, 2 days later when he returns home by himself. And he's really stricken by this. You know, he didn't have a good relationship with his father, but I mean, it was his dad. But then matters are only made worse. A few months later, his mom gets remarried, which like his father's body's barely cold and his mom's already getting married to a new person. So really even worsening Berdella's relationship with his family now. And at this point is when he kind of steps out on his own.
He became incredibly withdrawn and he kind of went back to his childhood liking. So painting, collecting coins and stamps, he actually wrote to a bunch of different foreign pen pals and they would trade stamps and coins. And that was so his, cool. His quote-unquote friends. Two of the big countries he'd write to is Burma and Vietnam, because like I said, he could get really cool stamps, he'd get different photographs, he could learn about different cultures, something vastly different from his Catholic culture.
Right.
By his mid-teens, he began, I don't want to say self-confidence, but it was self-confidence to the point that he would become rude to others. He'd be condescending, particularly towards women, which from what it sounds, he learned that from his father. I guess his father was abusive towards his mother as well. And plus that's all he grew up with was being abused. So obviously he's going to abuse other people.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of odd. Like Berdella has a few really good years, like barring some minor incidents, which we'll get into. Compared to his later crimes, yes.
Very true.
Compared to in his mid to late 30s, he had some really good years. He was going after goals, really kind of coming into himself, you know, really embracing his sexuality, things like that. Like, it seemed like he could have done really cool things instead of doing what he did. So in 1967, he enrolls in the Kansas City Art Institute. In his first year, he's considered talented and attentive. And then, like you said, by his second year, he is like vocally anti-authoritarian. He just becomes such a shithead. It gets worse. He becomes a minor drug dealer. He makes friends with the wrong people. At 19, he's arrested for attempting to sell methamphetamines to an undercover officer, posted bond, pled guilty, given a 5-year suspended sentence. 1 month later, he's arrested for possession of marijuana and LSD, could not post bail, spent 5 days in jail, but then charges were dropped due to insufficient evidence, which is weird because I don't really know how they could arrest you on a possession charge, but then not have evidence that you were possessing, yeah. Whatever. And anyway.
while all this was going on, he was engaging in acts of animal torture, which I'm not entirely sure how he didn't catch a charge for this.
Well, because he was doing it all in the name of art.
Yep. So there's two different incidences. The first one, he was torturing a duck and a chicken in the presence of his peers, which duck and a chicken. Okay. It's not right, but it's a duck and a chicken.
Right. I found one that said that he like killed, I think he killed the chicken and then cooked it as part of like an art performance.
I mean,
that is almost valid.
I've killed a chicken, eaten it because right. Well, I live in the middle of nowhere. That's normal.
Right, exactly. And like,
but I don't torture them.
Right, but then the next thing that he did.
Yeah, he started experimenting with sedatives and tranquilizers on a dog, which resulted in the dog dying.
Yeah.
Obviously, that is horrible. You don't do that. That's
right.
You know, killing people, okay. Killing animals, not so much.
That's where we draw the line.
Yeah, we draw the line at animals.
Leave the doggy alone. So in 1969, this baffles me. He wasn't kicked out of school. He dropped out after receiving criticism from college administrators. So you have to wonder how, like, was he such a fantastic student? Like, was he such a fantastic artist that they were like, we can't lose this kid. So we're just going to like slap him on the wrist. Like,
yeah, after he started, you know, torturing animals for art, I would be giving him the boot.
Right. But so he drops out, and then in September of 69, at the age of 20, he buys the house where he will live until his arrest, which is 4315 Charlotte Street in Kansas City. Fun fact, the house no longer exists. It was there is a house on that property, obviously, but that house itself was demolished in the 90s. So. Yeah,
they had problems with people breaking in and causing all sorts of chaos there.
I mean, not gonna lie, I looked it up because I was gonna go drive by and look at it. I live close enough.
Oh yeah, you're over there.
I mean I'm like 2 hours away, but like still, like I could pop on over to Kansas City and like look at the Brudella house, but yeah, no.
I mean I collect all that stuff, so it's cool for me. Like right. This week I got a piece of Gacy's house. I mean, how many people have a piece of Gacy's house? That's a very hard thing to get, but I tracked it down.
That's so cool. I was like, you have amazing sources.
I try.
Anyway.
It's taken years.
So in the 1970s, these are kind of the good years that I was really talking about. He became an accomplished chef, working at many restaurants and country clubs. He joined a local chefs association and trained aspiring chefs. Then he became really involved in his community and organized a local crime prevention and neighborhood watch, which is so funny with the fact that he's a serial killer later on.
Well, a lot of them have done it. Like BTK was actually, he worked for ADT installing alarm systems.
Yeah. And then it's so smart. Cause I guess if you train people to like look for certain things, you just avoid doing those things. So it's smart, but it's fucked up.
Well, and plus they were making, like BTK was making a ton of money doing it. Right. Everybody was scared of BTK and not knowing that that's right. Who's installing their alarms.
It's like, oh yeah, here, let me install this.
So like she said, the 70s, he actually did pretty good. He spent a lot of his time with male prostitutes, drug addicts, and petty criminals. The reason for this, he would befriend them and try to help them get rid of their drug addictions, get rid of their criminal lifestyles. And throughout this, pretty much the entire 70s, this is what he did. He's adamantly stated that he had no physical contact whatsoever with these individuals during this time, which... with his future, I don't know if I believe him.
Right, I don't know that I buy it. Also, he began renting space at a local flea market, selling oddities, antiques, and artifacts. And a little bit of a kind of, I'm going to lose the word. Sorry, you're going to hear my cat in the background. It's Louie. Hi. Yeah, you're being really disruptive. We're going to kind of flash forward a little bit. He meets Paul Howell, who is his booth mate at the local flea market. Paul Howell is the father of Berdella's first victim, Jerry Howell. He meets Jerry when Jerry is 14 years old. Jerry at the time is a blooming young man who is also finding out that he's homosexual, and really looks up to Berdella. Like, this man is flamboyantly gay and out and proud and doing cool things and just loved his lifestyle. And so, you know, Berdella actually made a really cool impact on Jerry when he was younger. So he also, during this time, started breeding chow chows as a hobby. And chow chows, if you don't know, it should definitely look them up. They're the like little lion. They're not little. They're like lion dogs. They're so fluffy and like teddy bears. And they're very cute. Just really fucked up.
They are adorable. I just looked them up.
They're so cute. And then in 1981, he quit working as a cook and bought a storefront and began working full time at Bob's Bazaar, bizarre, and it's backwards the way you think those bazaars should be, and it fucks me up every time. So it's Bob's and then Bazaar, B-A-Z-A-A-R, like a flea market place where you can find fantastic things, and then Bizarre, B-I-Z-A-R-R-E, as in weird and the abnormal. It should be the other way.
Believe it or not, I actually bizarre, go to bizarre. A really weird bazaar every year down in Bartonville. It's on the grounds of a former insane asylum. Of course. And they have like a bunch of artists come and food vendors. And this insane asylum was actually one of the really, really nice ones where the people actually did help them.
Oh.
Yeah. Like, they didn't have bars on the windows. They didn't use restraints a majority of the time. I mean, it was part of the community. They had their own zoo.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Unfortunately, it went downhill and now it's no longer there.
Most of
but them yeah, they have this bazaar there every year, which is kind of weird, but
that's so weird. Yeah, Bartonville of all places. Yeah, I don't think Bartonville, that sounds like a great place to go for like oddities.
I mean, it's connected to Peoria. What do you expect? As she stated, we're kind of going to jump ahead 4 years, because from 1980 to 1984, Berdella really didn't do a whole lot.
Yeah, he goes quiet.
Yeah. I mean, he kind of gave help to Paul Howell here and there. And
he did have a relationship. He was really emotionally involved with a very unstable Vietnam veteran. And that relationship wound up ending really, really poorly. This was in 82. And it's after that time that his activity with male sex workers really started to increase.
So, during the summer of 1984, Jerry Howell, who was his business partner's son that he met when he was 14, turned 19. And this is where Berdella starts to go downhill in a hurry. So Berdella is believed to have killed his first victim on July 5th, 1984, which was Jerry Howell, who he became reacquainted with about a year before he killed him. And he promised to drive the youth to a dancing contest in a nearby town. According to Berdella, he gave Howell a ton of alcohol, Valium, a drug I can't pronounce, which puts you to sleep. And
it's acetromazine.
That would be it. So kid became unconscious, and then he turned around and injected Howell with a heavy tranquilizer before binding the youth to his bed.
And Howell remained restrained to the bed for 28 hours. He was repeatedly drugged, tortured, raped, and sodomized with various household objects. His cause of death is named as asphyxiation, either due to aspirating or inhaling his own vomit and choking on it, or respiratory depression from the sedatives. So he was so sedated that his body just stopped sending, or his brain stopped sending the signal to breathe. And the one and only time this happened, Berdella attempted CPR. It was brief. He didn't do it for very long.
Yeah, he probably did it once or twice and did, yep, I'm done.
Well, you know, if you don't, if you're not trained in CPR and you just watch it on TV, no one ever does it right. It's like five compressions to like a breath. It's fine. Yeah. So he briefly attempted CPR. It obviously was unsuccessful. He then dragged the body down to the basement from the second floor bedroom.
And this is where it gets fun.
You take over then.
All right. So he then suspended Howell's body above a large cooking pot and made several incisions in the use inner elbows and jugular vein for leaving the pot in this, or the body suspended over this pot overnight to allow all the blood to drain out. Which McKenna brought up a great point before he started. Why are you using a cooking pot? Why aren't you using a bucket or some other form? But, you know, he's a serial killer. What do we expect?
And I don't get the impression that, like, he was spending a lot of time cooking, but still.
So the following day, he dismembered Howell's body using a chainsaw and boning knives before wrapping the sections in newspapers and trash bags. These bags were later placed inside larger trash bags, which Berdella placed outside for a garbage crew to collect and take to a landfill. Later, he got questioned by officers. Berdella claimed to have driven the youth to the nearby town to the dancing contest as promised, and that the two parted company, and he hasn't seen him since, which obviously was a lie because he carved him up like a Thanksgiving turkey.
That's why he used the stock pot.
Yeah, you know, it was... Okay, no, it wasn't even close to Thanksgiving. So he was just hungry.
July. So skip forward a year. And here's what's interesting is we don't, like, we have so much timeline up to 1984. We lose track of him here and there. He doesn't really do a whole lot interesting. But between murder to murder, there's not a whole lot. So I guess we assume he's going to work at Bob's Bazaar Bazaar, living a somewhat normal life.
Which is interesting, seeing as he killed this kid and then continued to work with his dad.
Right, and then went back to work the next day. I was like, hey, Paul, how's it going?
Yeah, oh, your son died? Oh, okay.
Oh, right. Or, oh, he went missing? Well, you know, he was a sex worker, so he's out doing stuff. Yeah, you know. So fast forward to April 10th, 1985, and we meet Robert Sheldon. And Sheldon, knowing how Berdella takes in sex workers and people that need it, he asks to stay, and then he never left. He was drugged with sedatives and held in the second floor bedroom for 3 days. Torture included, but is not limited to, swabbing drain cleaner into his left eye, inserting needles under his fingertips, binding his wrists with piano wire in the hopes of causing nerve damage, and filling his ears with caulk to decrease his hearing.
He's thorough. I'll give him that.
Yeah.
So 3 days after Berdella began holding Sheldon captive, a workman came to perform some schedule work on the roof of his home, leading Berdella to choose to fatally suffocate Sheldon and hide him in a third floor bathroom because obviously he didn't want the worker to find him. He later on dissected Sheldon's body in the third floor bathroom, which he was hidden inside of. It doesn't say how long after he did, but I'm assuming it was probably within the same day or two.
Yeah. And this is the first time that we know of that he takes a trophy. So he dissected Sheldon's body in pretty much the same fashion as Howell's, but he took his head and buried it in the backyard.
Which, it was kind of weird with Sheldon because at one point he took Sheldon to the doctor because the doctor was complaining of soreness, and obviously soreness was from the drugs, and then got drunk and begged Berdella to keep him. And that's when all this started happening. It's, you know, he could have got away and he didn't. Yeah. Which obviously he had no idea what was going to happen, but still he almost had a glimpse of humanity to him, and then he decided to murder people again.
Right. And it's really odd because Berdella does show these little glimpses of humanity every now and then.
I think he does have some. It's
his flaw at the end. It's his humanity and his like weird compassion almost. That is the reason that he gets caught, is because he almost gets lazy because he
he becomes complacent with it.
He does. And he really wants his victims to like him, it feels like.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's torturing them and abusing them, but he also wants them to stay forever.
Yeah. Because like we said, for a long time, that's what he did. He took care of people, took in the less fortunate. He was a great guy, and I felt that always stuck with him forever.
Yeah.
So the following June, Berdella found a gentleman named Mark Wallace, and he actually knew Mark because he helped him previously with some yard work. However, he found Mark hiding his tool shed to seek shelter from a severe thunderstorm. And just like Robert Sheldon, Berdella invited him into the house and noted that he was tense, there was a little bit of depression, so he volunteered to inject him with
chlorpromazine.
That's it. I love that you know all these. I should. And I don't. Do.
Well, part of it was I Googled them because I actually recognize the two medications that we've mentioned so far, the acetromazine and chlorpromazine. Both are used in humans.
Yeah.
But they're used as antipsychotics. And yeah. I was like, why does this man have these? Like, clearly you should be taking them. But it's because they're used as sedatives in dogs, which makes sense. He worked as a dog catcher in his, like part-time as a dog catcher, right?
Yes, for a very brief time.
And then also bred chow chows. So, of course, he has these medications that he's just appropriating and injecting into people.
Yeah, so Wallace willingly accepted this, and 30 minutes later, Berdella decided to render him captive. So he carried Wallace to the second floor bedroom, same place that one of the last people were tortured in, and endured almost a day of captivity before he started torturing him. And then the torturing began, and that was the application of alligator clips to his nipples to facilitate electrical shocks to his body at any point. At which point Wallace began regressing into a state of unconsciousness, according to Berdella. 1 hour after his experimenting. Oh, sorry, I read that wrong. So about 1 hour after his experimenting with hypodermic needles by inserting them into various muscles in the victim's back, Mark Wallace died from a combination of the drugs, the gag, and the lack of oxygen. And Berdella actually kept a log of everything he did to each person. And he noted the victim's time of death as being 7 o'clock on June 23rd, which is really creepy that A, he kept a log, and B, that he wrote down the exact times of these.
It's so fascinating. And I think it's because, like, I think each time he held somebody captive, he was looking for almost new and improved ways of torture. How can I get from point A to point B in a way that doesn't kill them? You know, and so I think that's why he's documenting this, because he wants to inflict as much torture as possible, but he's sick of his little pets dying.
Yeah.
You know. So then let's see, that was June 22nd, 1985. Now we're gonna go to September 26, 1985. So our increment of time in between our murders is really shortening here. he picks up a gentleman named James Ferris at a gay bar. And Berdella claims that Ferris was the first victim upon whom he intentionally inflicted torture, which is bizarre because the alligator clips didn't just randomly fall on their nipples. Like,
not everyone does that. That seemed
intentional, but I think it's more that he sought James out and he was like, you're coming home with me. I'm going to fuck you up. Yes. Whereas the other ones kind of fell into his lap and it just happened. It was like we had some foreplay and then the torture started. This was
went from foreplay to electrical nipple clamps.
Exactly. Hey, don't kink shame.
Oh, I'm not kink shaming. It's just the difference between kink and torture.
Well, fair. There's a safe word missing somewhere. Anyway, he drugs Ferris with some crushed tranquilizers concealed in his food. Then, of course, ties Ferris to the bed, as he does with everyone, tortured him for 27 hours until he died of asphyxiation. Torture for Mr. Ferris included repeated administration of 7,700 volt shocks to his shoulders and testicles at intervals of 5 minutes. And then acupuncture is used a little loosely here, with hypodermic needles to the neck and genitals. Oh, go ahead.
He informed investigators when he was asked about this, because they asked about his logs, and for the last three people, it was just
they kind of just petered out. There was no real details like, hey, what's up? Well, he actually quit making additions to his abuse logs because he assumed the victim would not make it much longer.
Right.
So pretty much after they became delirious or start to go unconscious, he quit writing down because he knew they were going to die.
And then James Ferris's death is noted in the torture log with just 86, which goes back to Berdella being a line cook and a chef. 86 means you're stopping an item, like 86 the onion rings because we're out, things like that. Like, it just means stop or it's done, which is just such a crass and like really just awful way of commenting on someone's death, especially since the last one was so nicely written as time of death, 7 p.m., June 23rd. This one's just 86.
Yeah, 86. Sorry.
We 86'd Ferris. He's done.
So our next victim, Todd Stoops, was a 23-year-old drug addict and sometimes prostitute who had briefly lived with Berdella twice in 1984. So after... Yes, with his wife, which is a little odd, but after Stoops and his wife moved out of Berdella's home the second time, Berdella didn't see him again until he just happened to run into him at a park in Kansas City on June 17th of 1986. Berdella wanted to catch up with him, said, hey, come get some lunch with me. And there was the added incentive that Stoops stated he needed $13 to buy drugs. So he said, hey, you know, come hang out, I'll give you the money, which really meant, hey, come have sex with me, I'll give you the money. And they actually put in here the equivalent of the $13 in 2021 is actually $31. So this guy ended up getting tortured and killed for $31.
Right. And this is one of the longest torture sessions, I think.
Yes.
That occurs as we both frantically rifle through the pages. This lasts 2 weeks. And it's the reason is because Berdella was extremely attracted to Stoops. He did not want him to die. He really wanted to keep him around and continue to play with him. And so over the 2 weeks, he just kind of gradually increased the terror to make him a cooperative sex slave. So as always, he's really liking the electrical shock tactic, but this time it's going to his closed eyes. He electrocuted Stoops' closed eyes in an attempt to blind him. He also injected drain cleaner into his larynx to silence his screaming.
I feel there's better ways to do that, I would think, but...
Yeah, I feel like there's better, like, mechanical means or non-drain cleaner means. I mean, he has access to so many sedatives. You can't tell me that he can't have access to, like, I don't know, a lidocaine?
Yeah.
Like, any kind of, like, lidocaine, prilocaine, anything like that would work a lot better.
Yeah. So, during the second week of his torture, Stoops asked Berdella for a soft drink and a sandwich. And if you're squeamish, this is where you want to stop listening. When Berdella refused, Stoops burst into tears. The very next day, he ruptured Stoops' anal wall with his fist, causing bleeding and discharge. And towards the end of Stoops' captivity, Berdella tried to feed him ice cream and soup, which you're kind of past that point.
We're a little too late. Yeah, there,
but Stoops wasn't able to keep anything down. And by the final day of his captivity, Stoops was so weak that Berdella stated that he was unable to breathe in a sitting position, which means if you aren't laying down, you're not breathing. And on July 1st, 1986, Stoops died, and a forensic pathologist later testified that the cause of death was the ruptured anal wall, which caused septic shock, which will kill you if not treated. So, yeah, if you're squeamish, I hope you didn't listen to that, because it sucks, but... It gets worse with the next one, even.
Oh, just wait. Yeah, there's more. So we fast forward a year. So I guess he spent 2 weeks with Stoops. So he had his fill for a little bit. And then June 5th of 1987, Larry Pearson becomes his next new plaything. He knew Pearson previously from Pearson visiting his store, Bob's Bazaar. Pearson was a fan of witchcraft. And then Pearson got into some legal trouble, and being the grand old friend that he is, Berdella bailed him out. Well, then Pearson began joking about his practice of robbing gay men in Wichita, which very obviously upset Berdella. Being a gay man, he was like, wow, this guy sucks. Like, I thought this guy was my friend. Turns out he's kind of a homophobic dick. Not saying that Pearson deserves what he got by any means, but just saying I can understand why this upset Berdella. So that evening, Berdella got Pearson drunk and then injected him with the chlorpromazine, his kind of go-to at this point, and then moved him down to the basement. I think this is the first time he's tortured somebody in the basement rather than upstairs in the second floor.
Yeah, it was always in the bedroom.
Yeah, which I think was also his bedroom. I think he was torturing these people on his bed.
It wouldn't shock me.
Right.
And then once again, he injected Pearson's larynx with drain cleaner. Once again, he likes a drain cleaner.
Yeah.
And then brought out an electrical transformer. Once again, he wants to use electricity.
Right. We're having fun.
Yeah. He keeps going back to these. I mean, I guess if it works, why change?
Does it work, though?
I guess it did for him.
God.
So, according to Berdella, Pearson was by far the most cooperative of the six murder victims. On the fifth day of his captivity, having endured torture for the entire 6 days, or sorry, five days, and the torture included repeated administration of electrical shocks to the transformer, big shocker, and breaking several hand bones with an iron rod to render him submissive, which I don't know if anyone else has broken bones in their hand. It hurts. It
hurts.
Let alone, you know, being shocked by electricity while he's doing it. That's
right.
Yeah. So Pearson was being cooperative up to this point still. And as a reward, Pearson was allowed to move into the second floor, with Berdella first informing Pearson that if he continued to cooperate, he would not continue to inflict as much pain upon him as he'd done while he'd been captive thus far. Which is kind of sick, saying, oh, I'm still going to torture you, but it's not going to be as bad.
Right. And I'm seeing now I was wrong that Stoops was the longest one, because Pearson's captivity lasted 6 weeks.
Yeah.
And during the latter part of those 6 weeks, Pearson even taught himself not to move while sleeping, so that way he could avoid upsetting Berdella. Like, he was this poor man. But then, like, Berdella also allowed him to, I think, like you said, like, dictate parts of his torture, except for the sexual part. He could dictate every other part, just not the sexual part. It was just very on. And then after 6 weeks, Pearson had had enough, and he bit into Berdella's penis hard enough to cause him to go to the hospital. Berdella arrives to the hospital with obviously a wound inflicted by somebody else, and you work in a hospital, you know, if somebody inflicts a wound, you have to file a police report. So he files a police report against, very creatively, a Larry Person, not Larry Pearson, a Larry Person. And then he's told that he's going to need to be admitted overnight, likely, I think, IV antibiotics and probably some sutures.
Yeah.
But when he's told that he has to get admitted, he's like, wait, hold on. I have to go home and I have to take care of my dogs really quick and get my dogs settled, and then I'll come back. So
he doesn't want the chow chows eating the dead body.
Yeah, well, but Pearson's not dead yet. He didn't kill Pearson yet. Pearson's sitting at home tied up while he's going and dealing with his poor penis. So he's like, hold on,
see, I have
my dogs.
And I thought he killed him before.
Back. No.
Because I have it here that he bludgeoned him into unconsciousness with a tree limb and then suffocated him before driving to the hospital.
Oh, no. He goes to the hospital first. I found two different resources that said that.
Which,
like, I fell in love with, because it's so fucked up. Goes to the hospital, leaves Pearson at home, goes to the hospital, is told he has to be admitted. He's like, hold on, gotta go take care of my dogs. Runs home, then bludgeons Pearson with a tree limb, suffocates him with a bag and ligature, and then goes back to the hospital, is admitted overnight to receive treatment, then returns home to dismember Pearson's body the next day.
I mean, at least he didn't leave him sit there all night.
I guess.
I mean, if it was me, I would rather just kill me now. Don't make me wait a day.
God. So then Berdella obviously dismembers him, like I just said. keeps his head in a plastic bag for a hot minute in the freezer, and then winds up burying it in the backyard where Sheldon's was. So he digs up Sheldon's skull and buries Pearson's head in the backyard and puts Sheldon's skull on display in his house. Later during police investigations, it's found in the closet. You can actually see pictures, the evidence pictures that show the skull on like the top shelf of his closet in his bedroom.
I didn't know that. I didn't get to see that one.
Oh, I'll find it for you.
I'll find it. Yeah. So there is a quote from that Robert Burdella. He actually wrote it down as part of his conversation with Christopher Bryson. He was talking to him back and forth. Says, "You did not choose to be here, but you are. For you to survive being here and for you to, you know, make it, it could be rough or it could be easy. If I grow to like you and to trust you, then I could do special things for you, such as buy you cigarettes, pick up a movie on the way home from work, and so forth. Don't try to fight me, or you'll just get more of what you had earlier. You see, what you got is nothing compared to what you can have." Which just shows how completely fucked up Burdella is.
Right, where he like thinks he's being so nice and courteous to these poor boys.
Yeah.
And so that was for Chris Bryson, right?
Yes.
Okay, so he's the next one. So Bryson was lured to the house with promise of payments for sex, obviously. Bryson was then knocked out and tied to Burdella's bed. And torture included similar methods as with the previous victims. We don't need to say it again. But this time we brought out something new, and he swabbed Bryson's eyes with ammonia.
And I mean, I've been around ammonia enough from, you know, doing jewelry and everything else. I've gotten polish in my eyes that have ammonia in it. Let me tell you, it burns a lot. That's the reason I don't use it anymore. After several days, Burdella explained to Bryson that he began to trust him and that he was willing to discuss aspects of the abuse and torture he was receiving. And there would be no negotiations pertaining to the sexual abuse, however, which is weird. Okay, I'll talk to you about torturing you, but not about fucking you.
Right. I get to call those shots.
Yeah.
Sure.
And he was quoted saying, "I've gotten this far with other people before, and they're dead now because of mistakes they made." So just telling Bryson, "Look, I've killed people. I have no problem killing you if you don't behave and don't listen."
And this is where, like we mentioned earlier, Burdella made his mistake, where he got lax. By day three, Burdella was leaving Bryson's hands tied in front of him rather than over his head. He left the TV remote in between his legs so that way he watched TV while Burdella was at work or in the other room. And then on April 2nd, 1988, Bryson freed himself by burning through his restraints with a forgotten book of matches and jumped from the second store window wearing only a dog collar, breaking his foot in the process. So Bryson is the one who gets away. He is not one of the victims. Bryson runs to a neighbor.
It was actually a meter reader that was across the road, like reading the gas meter. So imagine just going about your job, reading the gas meters, and you turn, there's this bloody beaten guy wearing a dog collar running at you.
Lord.
Yeah, I would be a little concerned. So obviously he led him to a house that he was going to read the meter for anyway, and the occupants called the police, which arrived minutes later.
And after Bryson's interview with the police, which there's a whole like three paragraphs that went into this. They like Bryson changed his story a bunch of times, saying that he was hitchhiking and got picked up. I guess not wanting to incriminate himself that he was a sex worker, but there's a whole back and forth with him and the police, and he changes his story a multitude of times. But despite that, it's enough that the police are like, this guy's very obviously been through something. And so after the interview, Burdella is arrested on charges pertaining to Bryson's sexual assaults. And there's enough evidence going on that they get a search warrant. And the search warrants revealed burnt ropes attached to the posts at the foot of the bed, which corroborates Bryson's story, the electrical transformer, a metal tray with syringes, prescription bottles, swabs, and eye drops, a long iron pipe, various lengths of rope and leather belts, the skull in the closet on the second floor, the partially decomposed in the backyard.
The cops went there and pretty much said, hey, we need to come in. He told him no, so they already had the warrant with them.
Yeah.
So there's like, yeah, you don't get a say. We're coming in.
Right.
Which and I these think cops that's...
think that they're like going to go in and it's like he's just some like sexual sadist gone wrong.
Yeah. He's but not expecting what they'll see.
Heads and then several human vertebrae were recovered and also two envelopes of teeth. And then, oh, wait, there's more behind the basement door. A hacksaw, a miter saw, a chainsaw, all soiled with blood, flesh, and pubic hair. And luminol tests showed that the basement floor was extensively bloodstained.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, makes sense. He was using a fucking chainsaw in his basement to cut people up. Of course it's extensively bloodstained.
Which, if you guys don't know, luminol tests, it makes blood glow bright blue. So think of like a black light. Yeah, that's what it's going to do, but it's in case, you know.
It's like the most fucked up rave ever.
Yeah, it's in case, you know, we tried to clean it up with bleach or something, that luminol will still detect it.
Yeah, it'll still fluoresce, which is so cool.
So, along with all the stuff that McKenna said they found, they also found 334 Polaroid pictures and 34 snapshot prints of various male individuals who they assume he tortured. They were stowed within various locations within Burdella's house. And this is actually where they knew Christopher Bryson was telling the truth, because he was pictured in a lot of these pictures. So these pictures showed people in life and death. And this also, he kind of had a progression of, you know, as he was torturing them. So they found pictures with needles. They found pictures of broken bones of people being tortured, and they were all here, and it was kind of messed up. He kind of had them in chronological order for each one, so you know they found him throughout the house, but it'd be, you know, a stack from the first victim, and you could go through them one by one and see progressively how it got. Which definitely, I know that I saw an interview with one of the cops and he said that stuck with him the rest of his life.
Oh, I can't even imagine. And then, of course, they discovered the stenographer pad, I think on the dresser in his bedroom. I read somewhere, but I didn't write it down, that he used to document each victim's torture. So really, all the information that we've shared today came from Burdella's own hands.
Yeah. And then obviously they found wallets with driver's license. Yeah. The wallet and driver's license, actually, one of them was for Jerry Howell, which is the kid he first killed. And the second one was James Ferris, who was actually a missing person.
And so initially, because here is, it makes sense. Possession of a skull doesn't mean you're a murderer.
No.
Fine. So despite everything that they have found, he's initially charged with one count of felonious restraint, one count assault, and seven counts of forcible sodomy. The majority of these, all of these, being on Bryson, right? Because Bryson's alive, so he's the one pressing charges. He's assigned a public defender and held in protective custody in Jackson County in lieu of a $500,000 bail, which I looked up is equivalent to $1.1 million today.
I didn't know that much.
In late April, Sheldon's skull is identified with dental identification. On that very same day, two separate calls come in identifying Wallace in photographs that were released to the public. They released the, as, would you shush, sir, not your podcast. It's not the Katie podcast. On the very same day that Sheldon's skull is identified with the dental identification, two separate calls come in identifying Wallace in photographs that were released to the public for identification. So they found the ones that were as least gross as possible, released them to the public saying, please help us identify these victims. So Wallace is identified. And then shortly thereafter, Larry Pearson's skull is identified on May 12th.
Yeah. So, and then around the same time, James Ferris's wife actually identified him through some of the pictures that were found.
Yes.
Unfortunately, some of these are after he was killed.
Yes.
The only other one that they have here was Paul Howell, which was actually his former business partner, identified one picture of a young man hanging upside down in Burdell's basement as his son, which obviously absolutely destroyed him because that's his son.
Right. And he's also the reason that, like, that they knew each other.
Yeah.
You know, So that's heartbreaking. And then on July 22nd, 1988, a grand jury formally indicts Berdella in the murder of Larry Wayne Pearson. The following month, he's arraigned and pleaded guilty to first-degree murder. He confessed under oath and is then transferred to the Missouri State Penitentiary to serve the life sentence that he got for that. He's temporarily placed in Potosi Correctional due to concerns for his safety, but then goes back to the state pen.
Sorry, I had to flip the page here. like you said, he got put back in Missouri State Penitentiary, which isn't even open anymore. It's actually a tourist attraction. It's really cool. I got to go there a couple of years ago. I did not know he was held there at that time, though. That's a second guilty plea was submitted before the court, and that earned Berdella a further life term, as if a couple weren't enough. And this was a life term without parole for one charge of forcible sodomy against Chris Bryson, six counts of sodomy, and one charge of assault being dropped as part of the plea bargain. As far as I'm concerned, they should have not given him a plea bargain at all, because they had enough to keep him in jail forever. Why bother with a plea bargain?
Right, exactly. Like, he's already serving life, but this guy got so many plea deals. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I guess you're right. He's going to be in prison forever. And I know later it's so that way they can get information. But it's bizarre to me that they're like, no, let's just take all these away. You only have to do one. It's fine.
Yeah. I would be pissed.
So then after initially pleading not guilty to the other five murder charges on September 13th of 1988, Berdella made, what do you know, a plea deal to confess to the murders in graphic detail. But this was so that way he could avoid the death penalty. So from December 13th through the 15th of 88, Berdella made his confession to the prosecutors. And finally, on December 19th, 1988, Berdella formally waived his right to be tried for any of the outstanding murder charges. And upon the understanding that he would be convicted on one more count of first degree murder for Robert Sheldon. So great, he's going to get convicted, but who cares? He's already going to prison for forever and he's not going to get put to death.
Yeah.
So he formally pleaded guilty in front of He formally pleaded guilty in front of Judge Robert Myers, who imposed five further concurrent life sentences and eliminated any prospect of parole.
Later on, Berdella did confess to having buried two of the victims' heads in the backyard. Obviously, one of them he dug up, that was Robert Sheldon, and the other one was Larry Pearson. Sheldon's skull was obviously placed in the closet where they found it then. According to this, though, he did later on, he did retrieve Pearson's skull one more time. He was letting it, what he calls skeletonize, which means all the flesh gets eaten away. It's just a skull left. And he claims there was no sinister reason for doing this. He just wanted the skull. And of course, the media was claiming that he was a Satanist. He wanted to do this for satanic reasons.
We're really in the beginning of like the ramp up of satanic panic. Like it's the late 80s. So satanic panic is really starting to like get going. So that makes sense.
How people ever believed it was ridiculous.
Oh, I love it. I love the whole satanic panic. I think it's just the most hysterical thing.
I find
even more hysterical is that like in the years following, Berdella like tried to restore his image to the public, and like he appeared on a couple different like news shows trying to like paint this image that he's this like, oh, sensitive citizen, he's a business owner, and he quote made mistakes.
Just minor mistakes, come on.
Sure, ringing somebody up wrong, giving them the wrong change, that would be a mistake. You tortured, sodomized, and killed people. No mistakes were had, sir.
Unfortunately, no bodies were ever recovered. Obviously, it'd been such a long period of time, and putting them in a landfill, good luck finding him. You know, where was the truck dumped? I don't know, somewhere in this, 100 mile landfill. We don't know where it's at.
Right. That's been getting filled and filled over the last four years.
Yeah,
good luck finding anything.
We may find him in another 100 years, but I doubt it. So following his, excuse me, his conviction and whatnot, he was locked up at Missouri State Penitentiary. He was locked up there until 1992 when he died. He did do interviews with a few people and corresponded with pretty much anyone who would write him. And like she said, he attempted to restore his image as a sensitive citizen who had made mistakes. Well, made mistakes in committing his crimes. Well, yeah, you got caught. That's what your mistake was.
Right. Yeah. That's all you're sad about. That's why you're trying to paint this picture. Like you're just upset that you got caught.
Yeah. And he claims that he was demonized unfairly by the media before, during, and after his arraignments and plea bargains, and that police ineptitude have resulted in him being allowed to remain at liberty for so long following his first murder.
Well, which that is delightful. Who are you mad at? Are you mad at the police or are you mad at yourself?
Yes. I mean, if they questioned you and didn't have any reason to arrest you and hold you, I mean, you can't blame them. They did their due diligence.
Right.
Which I do feel kind of bad for whatever cops questioned him back then. 4 years later, they find out he was this horrible serial killer. And like, oh, man, we probably dropped the ball on that.
Right. Like the ones that questioned him after Jerry that were like, they were like, they bought his story. And they're like, oh, fuck. Nope. He was cutting him up in the basement. Hours after we talked to him.
Oops. So during his incarceration, he lodged several complaints with prison officials regarding prison conditions, claiming that there was mold, there was unfair treatment, the same stuff that a lot of inmates write.
I did a bad thing. Now I'm in a bad place. Why isn't this the Ritz-Carlton? Woe is me.
The same thing they do nowadays.
He also wrote several letters to a local minister claiming that prison officers weren't giving him his medication for his hypertension.
That sucks.
Those claims were never founded. But then, of course, on October 8th, 1992, at 2 p.m., Berdella complains to staff of heart pain. He's determined to be unstable, and he's taken via ambulance to a hospital in Columbia, Missouri. I tried so hard to find which hospital this is. I'm pretty sure it was Boone Hospital. I don't see why they would have taken him to, the University Hospital. So I'm pretty sure he got taken to Boone Hospital.
It's possible. Sometimes they will actually have contracts with different hospitals.
Yeah.
Because the Illinois Department of Corrections takes everyone up to Chicago to a hospital. Unless it's, life or death right now.
And Boone Hospital Center used to be Boone County, Hospital. So it would make sense that he's transported to them. But anyway, I got a kick out of that. He's pronounced dead from a heart attack at 3:55 on October 8th, 1992. The death is never investigated. So despite all of his claims that he wasn't receiving his hypertension medication, the complaints of mold, all this stuff, the fact that he died of a heart attack, potentially secondary to not receiving his medication, never looked into. Yeah. Nobody was going to look into his death and
get
somebody in trouble.
Yeah.
For killing the horrible fucking serial killer, if that's what happens.
Yeah. And I did find this funny. So the judge that presided over the trial, Alvin Randall, was informed of Berdella's death. And in response, he sarcastically remarked, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
So beautiful.
Yep. I love that he gets the last laugh. So aftermath of this, in November of 1988, auctions of Berdella's vast collection of artifacts and furniture, which was all confiscated from his home and business, were auctioned off on 4 separate dates. And the intention of all the money raised to be used to pay off his legal fees and then ongoing legal proceedings, which obviously is never going to happen. But the auction attracted considerable national interest, attracting telephone bids from across the U.S., many of these items sold for less than expected price because nobody really cared back then. It was a serial killer. Who cared?
Right.
But by the end of the first day's auctioneering alone, more than $60,000 has been raised, and that's the equivalent of $130,000 nowadays.
Yeah.
That's quite a bit.
That is quite a bit.
For one day, that's And then Burdell's house was later purchased by a local businessman for an undisclosed sum in December of 1988. And the property was later demolished due to he's just tired of people showing up all the time.
Right.
People are always showing up. They wanted in. They wanted to see where stuff happened. And he said, screw it, and tore it down.
And one other thing I found, and this one's kind of, I mean, not like all of this hasn't been a bummer, but Todd Stoops's mother actually won a wrongful death civil suit against Burdella and was Todd Stoops's mother wins a wrongful death civil suit against Burdella and is awarded a record $5 billion. Burdella at this point has been in prison for years. He can't pay this amount. So Stoops's mother has claim on any future earnings he might make. That was January of 92. The motherfucker died 10 months later. She didn't see a dime out of that.
Of course. And that's always how it ends up, every time.
Of course.
So that is Robert Burdella, Kansas City butcher, the collector. There's all sorts of names we have for him. So that is going to be it for this week. Who are we covering next week?
I don't know. We haven't decided yet. Look at your magical list of magical people.
Let's see. Well, it'll be a surprise. We'll cover some killer next week. Oh, let's see. Who are we on? Ooh, David Berkowitz, who is the son of Sam.
Yes, son of Sam next week, everybody. All right. Well, so next week we will be covering the son of Sam. So until then, this has been the Behind the Bars podcast.
See everyone next week.
Bye, guys.